Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Deputy Public Defender Karen Noxoni on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Angela Stenger. Your Honors, I have asked of the clerk to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, in this case, the Intermediate Court of Appeals summary disposition order granted a new trial because the ICA found that a claim of right defense instruction was improperly denied. However, in this application, we raised two grave errors where the ICA rejected the two other instructions requested by the defense on appeal, that being the unanimity instruction, a specific unanimity instruction based on State versus Arceo, and the second instruction being the mistake of fact defense instruction. We are asking that this court require on remand that both of these instructions be given. It would bring consistency to the ICA's ruling on the claim of right defense instruction, and it would then adequately protect the defendant's constitutional rights to unanimity, to due process, a fair trial, and a right to fully present a defense. Turning now to the first issue of the unanimity instruction. The seminal case in this regard is State versus Arceo. Arceo says that if no election is made by the prosecution at the close of the prosecution's case, and there are then two triggers present for a specific unanimity instruction, the two triggers are present, then the court must give the jury an instruction telling them that whatever act or acts they base their conviction on, they must be unanimous as to whatever act or acts. And the two triggers for Arceo unanimity instruction are these. First, are there separate and distinct acts, culpable acts subsumed in a single count? And the second trigger is there a danger that the jury's conviction is predicated on disparate factual findings? In this case, Your Honors, there was a danger that the jury's verdict was predicated on disparate factual findings. This is a case where you had multiple acts, multiple theories of liability, and multiple intervening, what we would submit, exculpatory acts by the defendant. You also had the attendant circumstance of value at play here, and the grade of offense was dependent on the value. And so depending on what acts or combination of acts the jury found, which of the multiple theories of liability the jury applied, that would affect the value of the total theft amount. And so you also had a case where there was not a single type of non-reporting. There were five different kinds of non-reporting theories advanced by the state. You had the non-reporting of the twin children, the non-reporting of the daughter Kiana, who moved to the mainland, the non-reporting of the inheritance check for $5,000, non-reporting of DOE income and a business income from the Hawaii Surfing Alliance. So depending on which type of non-reporting the jury based its verdict on, one or all of them, that would affect the total value of the offense. This is also a case where you did not have consistent or constant non-reporting throughout the indictment period. And so depending on whether the jury credited any of the acts by the defendant, like for the twins, she did report in December 2002, she sent a note saying they go back and forth from my house to the volunteer sitter's house. For the DOE income, she did report by sending a note at the end of February 2003 that she had started working. And then you see a bunch of paychecks in March, April, and May.
So, counsel.
Yes.
Did the prosecutor argue that any of these combinations could be found to find the person, the defendant guilty of the crime? What were the representations made by counsel for the prosecution regarding it being a continuous offense that they were prosecuting this person, defendant for, or were these separate offenses that you're claiming they allege?
Prosecution argued all of these theories, but in the closing argument, we do footnote this in the application. They also said to the jury, you could find the defendant guilty based on just one of the types of non-reporting. He specifically argued that if the jury were to find that she would not have even qualified for assistance based on her non-reporting of the HSA business income on the first application, that would be enough for them to find guilt on the charged offense of theft in the first degree. The danger here was that we don't know how the jury arrived at their verdict. And because of the denial of the defense, and we, the strengths of the defense.
You're saying that the argument did focus upon this, any combination or any one of these offenses could be the basis for a guilty verdict, is that right?
They argued all of them, yes. And throughout their proof, they proved the various different kinds of non-reporting. And at the end, they were arguing all of them. And so, where we disagree strenuously with the ICA's conclusion is, the ICA just accepting as face value that this is a continuing offense and therefore exempt from the Arceo unanimity instruction requirement because the state treated it as a continuing offense. I mean, they devote two sentences to the unanimity holding. They say first, the ICA treated it, the state treated it as a continuing offense, therefore it is a continuing offense. We disagree with that. And then secondly, the ICA says, State versus Rabago and State versus Martin, the relevant precedent says that theft by deception is a continuing offense. So if they can pigeonhole it into a continuing offense, then they don't have to give an Arceo unanimity instruction. But what we are saying is the fact that the state treated it as a continuing offense does not make it so. The state is allowed, yes.
Somewhat related to that is the fact that the defense requested instructions on theft in the third degree and theft in the fourth degree. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why did the court grant the request for an instruction on theft in the second degree?
Your Honor, I don't specifically recall, but the defense did submit those instructions. So to grant it, to include those instructions, the court must have found that there was a basis in the evidence that the jury could find that the total value over $20,000 may not have been proven, so the lesser offense would then be allowed.
Well, it was a court supplemental instruction. But in any event, on theft in the second degree, if you can give an instruction as to theft in the second degree, then can you infer from the evidence that you could separate out different amounts with respect to different violations?
Yes. In this case, the main testimony on that point came from Nina Vallejos, the lady who did the computations for DHS. And so our position is there was nothing, based on her testimony and the way it came out, there were not a whole lot of specifics in terms of breakdown that she gave in her testimony. But there was enough there where the jury could compartmentalize liability. And if the defense had been granted the instructions, the jury could have then tried to apply the defenses with respect to the different pieces of the state's case. Nina Vallejo said, quote, "I found that she, with her income that she failed to report, some months is eligible, some months is not eligible." Nina Vallejos also said with respect to food stamps and medical insurance that the defendant was eligible in her own right, that she did not require declaration of the children in order to be eligible. So the facts that she bases her calculation on, the facts change, the amount of the total overpayment changes, and that would affect the grade of offense. Now, if I could go back to the state treating it as a continuing offense. This is a case where the state is only allowed to treat it as a continuing offense by virtue of the aggregation statute. If you look at the aggregation statute, 708.801 sub 6, that is by definition a separate and distinct acts combined into, if the prosecution feels in their discretion that the separate and distinct acts comprising these multiple acts and amounts involved in the multiple thefts, if they feel that they constitute one scheme or course of conduct, then the prosecution is allowed to aggregate. So you have the first Arceo trigger being met here in an aggregation theft case. because you're aggregating separate and distinct acts of theft under the aggregation statute. The second trigger of Arceo is also met here, and unanimity instruction was required because this is not a case where you had the same identical act of theft, of non-reporting over and over and over. This is not a case where the state had one clear path to conviction. This is a case where the jury had many different paths to conviction on theft in the first degree, and so there was a danger that the jury based its verdict on disparate factual findings, and Arceo instruction was required. The fact that the state treats it as a continuing offense for aggregation purposes, they are allowed to do that, but it should not make it, and it does not make it, a continuing offense exempt from Arceo unanimity review or scrutiny where such a conclusion flies in the face of the evidence as the evidence comes out. Now, the second reason why the ICA said it's a continuing offense is they cite the case of State versus Rabago and State versus Martin. Our position is State versus Rabago stands for a completely opposite proposition. Rabago stands for the proposition that calling it a continuing offense does not make it so. In that case, the court, the majority of this court, said that a new statute, continuing sex assault of a minor, the legislature called it a continuing offense. It did not make it per se a continuing offense. The Rabago majority refused to accept the legislature's declaration that that was a continuing offense. The majority actually examined the conduct element to see whether it was actually multiple acts or not. And in footnote 15, this court said, you can't transform a cow into a horse merely by declaring that the cow is a horse. And this court decried a, quote, uncritical willingness to accept that an offense describes a continuing course of conduct simply because the legislature said so. And the tautological conclusion that jury unanimity as to each act is then unnecessary because the offense supposedly entails a continuing course of conduct. Yet that's exactly what the ICA and the state are doing here. There is an uncritical acceptance that theft by deception is a continuing offense merely because the 30-year-old case of State versus Martin says it is. There's an uncritical acceptance that it's a continuing offense despite what the evidence shows. Now, State versus Martin, our position is State versus Martin does not stand for the proposition that all theft by deception cases are a continuing offense. Martin stands for the proposition that a court must look at the evidence to see if the continuing offense definition articulated by this court in Martin is met. Now, it's important to note that State versus Martin, all the subsequent case law, Rabago, Arceo, credits Martin as standing for the proposition that theft in the first degree by deception is a continuing offense. But that's a 1980 case, it's 30 years old, it's pre-Arceo. There's no discussion of unanimity, aggregation, or multiple acts in State versus Martin. State versus Martin says you have to look at the evidence and see if the evidence discloses one general intent or separate and distinct intents. And if there's only one intention, one general impulse, and one plan, even though you may have a series of transactions, there is then only one offense. So the Martin court used this formulation, this definition of continuing offense, applied it there, and that is a case where you had all of the monthly statements identical. It is the same act of theft repeated exactly identically, representing that the defendant in Martin was unmarried, unemployed, and not receiving Social Security benefits. So here we have a very different case from what the Martin court had.
Counsel?
Yes.
Did the state break out what the overpayment was per violation or with respect to any category of violation? In other words, did the state say the fact that the defendant deposited or did not report receiving $5,000 as an inheritance resulted in an overpayment of $200 or something to that effect?
No, they did not break it down that specifically. There's only the state's exhibit number 78, the schedule of overpayment calculation. So it's a chart.
I admit this question is not directly related to the unanimity issue, but somewhat related. Was there a rational basis in the evidence for the court instructing the jury on theft in the third degree?
Yes, because The breakdowns are not specifically given, but there is enough there in Nina Vallejo's testimony where she says the federal thresholds are such and such amount. There's enough there in terms of facts for them to remove certain amounts from the overpayment schedule. If
so, would that same logic apply to instruction on theft in the fourth degree?
Theft in a fourth degree, there's no specified value.
It was fourth in the theft in the fourth degree. Sorry, it's the afternoon. Say that the amount cannot exceed $100?
Yes.
So was that the same rationale that the court used in giving the instruction for theft in the second degree?
No, I don't recall specifically, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Sorry. Thank you.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. There were a number of exhibits, separate exhibits, that pointed to specific amounts, right?
Yes.
And you could identify these amounts to be related to HMSA or to inheritance or to, right?
Yes.
But what do you say there wasn't a breakdown?
In terms of the overpayment schedule that Nina Vallejos prepared in State's Exhibit 78, she just lists month by month what was paid, what the client was eligible for. But when she says what she was eligible for, it doesn't really explain that. There is just a blanket explanation on the bottom of the exhibit saying explanation for the whole chart. It doesn't say which explanations are pertinent to which numerical figures. It just says failure to report income from DOE, self-employment income, children out of the home, inheritance for grandfather's estate in April 2003. So it's there generally, but I mean the jury, there was nothing preventing the jury from trying to apply it themselves. But there was nothing specific from Nina Vallejo saying how each specific fact would affect each specific month calculation of overpayment. So it did not get that specific. But for our purposes, for the defense, because of, you know, as I described the multiple theories of liability, you have the defendant disclosing certain things. Maybe she didn't disclose on the proper form. Maybe she disclosed late. Maybe she didn't do enough disclosure. I mean, the disclosures, you know, the state would argue were flawed. The state would argue should not be credited at all. But we're saying that disclosures were made, and if the jury was properly instructed on the two defenses, the claim of right and mistake of fact, that it would have allowed the defense to mitigate the total value of the offense that she was ultimately convicted of. Now, let's see.
Are you on your second point?
I'm sorry?
Are you on your second point?
My second, I can go there, mistake of fact.
If you have a right of claim instruction, which now you have, do you need a mistake of fact instruction? In addition to that?
Yes, our position is we did need it.
Why would you need it?
Because the attendant circumstance element here is theft by deception. So we needed to have the instruction in order to be able to explain to the jury that her mistaken belief with regard to her initial application for the MRF forms, she mistakenly believed that whatever impressions she left with whatever paper she did file was not false. And that's the definition of deception. 708-800 has a specific definition. And let's
Is right of claim simply a subspecies of mistake of fact?
They are related offenses such that evidence to support claim of right could also support mistake of fact, because we're both arguing the defendant's belief, as one is she believes she was entitled. The other defense goes specifically to she believed that she did not create any false impressions by what she disclosed or did not disclose or failed to correct after the first disclosure. And so it goes to claim of right, but it also goes to mistake of fact.
Is there a mistake of fact every time there is a claim of right?
I believe so, because the way the offenses both require an assessment of the defendant's belief as related to a particular element of the charge.
How about the other way around? Is there always a claim of right every time there is a mistake of fact? Claim of right is actually a species of mistake of fact, isn't it?
Yes.
It's kind of like every Super Bowl is a football game, not every football game is a Super Bowl, right? Super Bowl would be like the claim of right. Football game is a more all-encompassing mistake of fact, right?
Yes.
So what's the difference between the two?
Well, in this case, we had evidence to support mistake. The same evidence, we said, would support claim of right.
Well, that kind of gets back to Justice Acoba's original question, though. If you got a mistake of fact, let's say, why would you need a claim of right?
Well, our position is, the legal standard is if we should get, if the evidence discloses that any evidence of mistake of fact, and we're saying that it did. It did support claim of right, which we specifically asked for, but the evidence here also supported mistake of fact.
Which you didn't ask for.
We did not ask for it. Maybe
defense counsel should have asked for mistake of fact instead of claim of right, because it was more appropriate under these factual circumstances for a mistake of fact instruction to go in rather than claim of right.
Perhaps. But the case we would point to State versus Riviera, which is cited in our application, which says that even though a request for an instruction may have been ineptly worded or inaccurate in some particular, and that's what we said happened here.
I'm sorry. Oh, go ahead. I just wondered, do you agree with the ICA your client doesn't have a claim of right under the Model Penal Code?
I'm sorry, Anna, I didn't look at that question very closely.
Well, that's sort of the linchpin of their analysis.
Yeah.
Because they differentiate between the Model Penal Code and Hawaii Penal Code. And to begin by saying that your client did not have a claim of right under the Model Penal Code. And I guess I want to know whether you agree with that or not.
Well, we do agree with that.
Then you think the IC's analysis is faulty then?
The IC's analysis is faulty in that they reject a mistake of fact, but they agree that the evidence shows a claim of right. And we're saying that the evidence to support claim of right also supports a mistake of fact. That's our position.
Would you entertain the possibility maybe they just got it backwards and that what should have been given was mistake of fact instead of claim of right, because mistake of fact is appropriate under these factual circumstances and claim of right is not?
That may be what this court decides, but we're saying that we had no quarrel with the IC's holding on claim of right.
It got her a new trial.
Yes. Yes, to be frank, that's why we didn't raise it. But
Well, you have no choice now, right? You get the claim of right instruction whether you like it or not.
I think so, yes.
That's the ICA's holding, and this court denied cert on that question.
Right.
The commentary says that both defenses, i.e. mistake of fact and claim of, mistake of fact, is probably unnecessary in light of an informed reading of the substantive divisions of the various modes of conduct, so that if you have a mistake of fact instruction, then do you really need a claim of right instruction?
Perhaps not.
Okay, but in this case, you do need a mistake of fact instruction.
We do need a mistake of fact instruction.
Because if you look at claim of right, at least the Hawaii precedent, that claim is related only to a specific property, is it not?
Yes.
Breiter. You're familiar with Breiter?
State versus Breiter.
Yes. Well, assuming Breiter says that, in this case, we're not talking about specific property.
We're not talking about a specific what?
We're not talking about specific property, i.e. specific bills or coins. We're talking just about money in general.
Yes, amount of theft, yes.
So in order to, at least if you follow our precedent, in order to reach mistake of fact, you would have to be talking about monies in general.
Yes.
Or money in a general sense.
Yes, okay. Now I'm out of time, so I would like to reserve whatever remaining time I have. I think it might be just a few minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Lawrence Goya. I'm the Senior Deputy Attorney General for the State of Hawaii. If I may begin, Your Honor. Your Honor, obviously contrary to the argument of Ms. Nakasone, we do obviously disagree. We do believe that the Intermediate Court of Appeals did rule correctly in terms of the issue of unanimity in its decision in this case. As the court is well aware, the critical issue is whether the offense that was charged was in fact a continuing offense or not. And the reason for that is, according to the case of State versus Hironaka, if it was in fact a continuing offense, then the unanimity instruction is not required. If the offense is defined as a continuing offense and the prosecution alleges and argues and adduces evidence of the offense being in fact a continuing offense, then again the unanimity instruction does not apply. As opposing counsel mentioned, the seminal case on the issue of unanimity jury instructions is State versus Arceo. And it defines what a continuing offense is. It says that a continuous offense is a continuing unlawful act or series of acts set on foot by a single impulse and operated by unintermittent force, however long it may occupy, or an offense which continues day by day, or breach of the criminal law, not terminated by a single act of fact, but subsisting for a definite period and intended to cover or apply to successive obligations or occurrences. We submit to the court that the offense that was charged here, theft in the first degree, and as its basis, welfare fraud, was in fact a continuous offense in that it did comply with the last portion of the definition under RCO. That being, it was a breach of the criminal law, not terminated by a single act or fact, but subsisting for a definite period and intending to cover or apply to successive similar obligations or occurrences. And what we are submitting to the court is that what the similar obligations or occurrences in this case were the obligation of the defendant to correctly report her financial and personal status to the Department of Human Services so that they could get a clear idea of what her financial status was and determine whether she still maintained her eligibility for the welfare benefits. Okay. Now, yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Nakasone, I think, represents that you, the prosecution, argued that any different combinations of acts could be to find the defendant guilty of the charge of theft.
Well, Your Honor, I beg
and
to differ.
You also argued continuous offense.
I'm sorry?
You also argued a continuance of the offense, but you also...
Well, essentially what we argued, Your Honor, and what we charged the defendant with was theft by deception. In other words, that there were different forms of misinformation that was provided or information that was withheld from the Department of Human Services. But they all came under the category of deception. In other words, withholding or providing misinformation about critical information that the Department of Human Services needed in order to determine the defendant's eligibility. Now,
I understand that you argued that all of these offenses were a continuous activity of this one offense. But you said you also indicated any combination of these could amount to the charged offense.
Again, I think I differ from that characterization, Your Honor. Essentially, what we're saying is that there were these acts of deception that were continually being committed by the defendant. And that was the thing that prevented her, in our view, from being eligible for the benefits that she was receiving, and which, in fact, turned these acts into criminal offenses.
What about the distinction that she makes with the Martin case, indicating that in Martin, the various acts were identical?
Well, again, I point back to the definition that I just read the court. The definition I read is from Arceo, which is a 1996 case. I believe that this definition is repeated in a number of more recent cases, Hironaka, which is a 2002 case, and Rubago, which is a 2003 case. So essentially what we are submitting is that our focal point was on the part of the definition which talked about successive similar obligations or occurrences. Again, the obligation being that she had to correctly report certain information about either her financial status or her personal background, and she failed to do so. And by failing to do so, she received welfare benefits that she was not entitled to. And that is the crux of the offense here.
You did argue to the jury, though, that the jury could aggregate the different, I don't think you argued violations, but the different overpayments to reach the $20,000 amount.
Well, I believe I have an excerpt of my closing argument, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I believe it is on pages 36 and 37 of the transcript of the June 6, 2005 proceedings.
Yes, and on page 38, too.
Yes. And basically what I said, Your Honor, at the time was the next, and in parentheses, part of the charge, is that the value of the property exceeded $20,000. And as the court will read you an instruction, amounts of theft committed pursuant to one scheme or course of conduct can be aggregated. In other words, added together in determining the class or grade of the offense. And what that simply means is that you may find Angela Stenger had committed theft. You can add up all the different instances where she had committed theft and coming up with a final total, which will be the determination of what kind of theft occurred in this case. And what we're saying here is that it was over $20,000. And we know that by a set of calculations that the last witness, Nina Vallejo, calculated.
Why did you agree to an instruction on theft in the second degree?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe I did agree.
You did it. Well, according to the court record, it says given by agreement.
That may well have been, and to be frank, I can't remember exactly what I may have done at that point, but assuming that I did, I think the court had indicated that it was inclined to give the instruction, so I felt that in terms of the strength of our case, we believe that we had in fact proved theft in the first degree. So in terms of our opposition for the theft in second degree jury instruction, we didn't feel it was necessary to argue against that.
Why don't you argue against it?
Well, Your Honor, I think the thing is that I've been practicing long enough to realize that there are certain things that judges do, and oftentimes they're a matter of compromise rather than necessarily necessity. In this particular case, I don't know what was in Judge Perkins's mind, but my reading of him was that he felt that it was necessary, and again, given the strength of my case, I wasn't about to fight him over it.
Thank you.
Well, in any event, Your Honor, continuing on with my argument, the case of Arceo again continues on to give examples of what continuing offenses are. And it specifically names as example 5, theft of state property by deception. And clearly that is the kind of case that we have here. And it goes on to say that each of these offenses is statutorily defined as an uninterrupted and continuing course of conduct or manifests a plain legislative purpose to be treated as such or both. So clearly, in terms of the kind of offense that we have here, the legislative branch of our government had decided to specifically designate these kinds of offenses as continuing offenses, and that is the basis on which we pursued our prosecution. In terms of the age of Martin, again, Martin, I believe, was probably the first case that specifically dealt with welfare fraud cases. But again, we go back to the fact that in Ribago, which I believe is the latest case which talks about unanimity instructions, again, it does point out the fact that theft by deception is a continuing offense. So clearly, Martin is not outdated. It has not been overruled. It is still current law. And I believe that in terms of the basis for the defendant asking for a unanimity instruction, there is no basis for that. Clearly, we meet the exception that was provided for by Hironaka, which basically said that if you have an offense that qualifies as a continuing offense and you argue it as such, you present your case in such a manner and you produce evidence to support that argument, then a unanimity instruction is not necessary.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
If the judge felt that a theft in the second degree instruction should be given, then should the judge also have given a theft in the third degree and a theft in the fourth degree instruction?
Well, Your Honor, if I remember what Judge Perkins said, I believe he essentially said that in his mind there was no basis for either theft in the third degree or theft in the fourth degree jury instruction.
He said there was no rational basis in the evidence. But If that is true, was there any rational basis in the evidence for giving a theft in the second degree instruction?
I wish I could give you that answer, Your Honor. I think what it would require me to be is basically a mind reader. And unfortunately, I don't know what Judge Perkins's specific rationale was, other than he did say that it was a jury instruction that he intended on giving.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess the last thing that I would like to argue is the mistake of fact issue. It is our position, Your Honor, that again, the mistake of fact, your instruction was not required. Under the particular facts of this case, it was clear that the defendant had been counseled about what her reporting responsibilities were. She knew that she was under that obligation. She had been a prior welfare recipient. It was not something that was brand new to her. And the kind of rationale that was given for her having a mistake of fact jury instruction, in my mind, was basically an argument that the defendant was saying she knew that there was a reporting obligation. It was just that in her own mind, she felt that she wasn't required to make that report. So I submit that what that means to me is that she knew what her obligations were. It was simply that she chose for her own reasons not to report and claim mistake. It was not a true mistake. And again, based on those kinds of facts, I do not feel the mistake of fact instruction was warranted.
Well, one of the arguments she made was that her substitute DOE instruction payments were intermittent or temporary, and she was under the impression that reporting only applied to regular employment. If that's the case, would that be a mistake?
Not according to my reckoning, Your Honor. Again, the instructions that she received were very clear. Any kind of change in financial status had to be reported. Any kind of change in a personal status had to be reported. Again, if we look at what she did, it wasn't that she said, I didn't know that I didn't have to report. It was simply that, in my mind, it didn't qualify. And it was her interpretation of what the requirement was. It wasn't the fact that she didn't know that the requirement existed. So on that basis, I submit that the mistake of fact jury instruction was not warranted.
So when you go back to trial, if you get a mistake of fact instruction, and you will get a claim of right instruction, is there any problem for the jury?
Well, I think the thing is that I would have preferred that obviously we weren't required to have those kinds of instructions, because I think it would more confuse the jury rather than clarify the issues for the jury's determination. But given the fact that the court has ruled, obviously we will abide by that and deal with it as best as we can.
If the evidence remains the same, you didn't object to the instruction for theft in the second degree. So I assume you would not object to an instruction on third and fourth degree.
Well, again, I think the thing is that the court had...
Well, at some point, I understand what the court's position is, at least. its ultimate decision, but at some point you would have to take a position,
right? Well, Your Honor,
well, it's entirely up to you. I guess yes. You don't have to.
Well, I think the thing is, again, if the evidence turns out the way that it did, excuse me, in the first trial, I feel that we approved our case. And if it were up to me, I would basically ask the court just for a theft in the first degree instruction and object to any other kind of instruction. Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure if there are any other questions from the court, but I believe I've exhausted my argument, and I'll sit down unless there are any further questions.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
State versus Martin. Let's see. The prosecution said State versus Martin is good law, and we're not saying that State versus Martin is not. We're just saying that State versus Martin does not stand for this blanket proposition that all theft by deception offenses are continuing offenses. Martin says you have to apply their analysis of continuing offense, match it up, apply the analysis to the evidence is how it comes out to see whether it truly is a continuing offense. And so that's, and under the Martin definition here, we're saying there is no continuing offense. And so the evidence should be subject to unanimity review under the State versus Arceo standard. By giving the theft second degree instruction, I would argue that's a implicit recognition that it's a multiple, separate, distinct act prosecution. If you give theft in the second degree, then there's an acknowledgement that the defense that's mounted or the mitigation that's presented by the defense could affect the calculations and bring down the offense maybe below theft in the first degree. So it recognizes, by giving the theft second degree instruction, the trial court is recognizing the compartmentalized nature of the prosecution as well as the compartmentalized nature of the defense. The defenses that we tried to raise of claim of right and mistake of fact, they didn't apply uniformly across the board. They applied to certain aspects of the prosecution. They were stronger on certain points, weaker, but the point is they didn't apply uniformly. So if you give a theft second degree lesser included offense instruction, the court in so doing is recognizing that if you could take out portions of the overpayment amount, you can only do that if you recognize that the prosecution is not a continuing offense prosecution, that it's bits, it's pieces of theories that you pull together, and if you take certain pieces of the prosecutor's puzzle out, depending on how much you credit each explanation by the defendant, you can get to amount below theft in the first degree.
Opposing counsel said you're not entitled to a mistake of fact instruction. Why are you?
Your question was why?
Opposing counsel said you are not entitled to a mistake of fact instruction.
Yeah.
Why are you?
We are entitled to a mistake of fact instruction because deception is an attendant circumstance element of theft in the first degree. Deception requires for the jury to find deception, it requires a finding that they believe, that the defendant believed, that something on what she disclosed or did not disclose was not true. So it requires the jury's assessment of her belief regarding the falseness or truth of the impression she leaves on her initial declaration, on the monthly forms, on the letter she sends to Ms. Cardenas. So there is evidence of mistake of fact as to that particular attendant circumstance element, and that's why we should get mistake of fact. The standard is not the strength of the evidence, but any evidence, and we met that very low threshold for giving of the defense instruction. There's any more questions? I see that there's none. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement.